Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mark Gillette is a board-certified family medicine physician. He grew up helping his dad in his veterinary practice and always enjoyed medical research. He enjoys practicing at Gillette Health with his son, Dr. Kyle Gillette, and his areas of clinical focus include family practice, allergy, dermatology, infertility, pediatrics, preventive medicine, weight loss management, and sports medicine. Dr. Gillette believes in communicating extensively and openly with his patients to help them enjoy the best health possible. Tell me about your path into the career of medicine. So is this something you were always interested in? Did you have a big event that sort of steered you in that direction? Tell me a bit about how you got started.
I suppose helping my dad, who was a veterinarian, did probably get me started in being interested in healthcare things. And being somewhat allergic to cats, human medicine seemed like a good way to go. And that was kind of a process that I arrived at. I really enjoyed working with my dad and helping living creatures be healthier and have better lives. I remember one time, I was probably 5 years old, and he took me on, he did large animal and small animal, and he took me on a call, and there was a colt being born, but it was Breech. Its rear legs were coming out first, and it had gotten stuck. And of course, I didn't know that. We just drove up, and I saw a little baby horse about halfway into a mama horse who was standing at the time. And of course, I asked my dad, What happened? And he was trying to get there and help. And finally I asked him, well, tell me, how did that little one get in there? He must have been going awfully fast. And my dad explained some of the facts of life to me, I think, yeah, at that point. And he thought that was very funny, that I thought that's how the little one got in there. So
yeah, seeing the world through the eyes of a child, there's a different perspective on things a lot of times, and often a comical one. Yeah, that's a story I'm sure he told many times afterwards.
He did. He thought that was very funny, as did my mom when he told her.
Yeah, so treating everything from kittens to horses, so equine medicine. I imagine it's a little bit harder to get the history from a patient that doesn't speak, that can't really tell you what's going on, what's hurting, give you a history. So you've got to kind of read between the lines there. But that is one unique feature of human medicine, is that you can take a history from a patient. And I've heard from many who I consider my mentors and teachers that if you talk to the patient long enough, they will tell you what's wrong. So that's part of where being able to spend long enough with a patient really starts to matter. So is that a similar experience if we go all the way back to, medical school, learning to take that initial history? Is that something that you would say is the case as well?
Yes, I definitely agree that my dad had to have very good physical examination skills, because he thought animals could kind of talk to him, but they didn't talk to me, so I needed to talk to a human being. And I knew I wanted to do this type of broad scale of medicine that he did, So I signed up with the American Academy of Family Practice the week I matriculated at medical school. I was fortunate enough to be able to attend the University of Kansas Medical School, which was and probably still is one of the top 10 medical schools in primary care in the country, and had very good education there and had a very good residency through the University of Texas Health Science System, and where we were the only residents, most of the places the family physicians were. And so we got to do the obstetrics and the surgery and the pediatrics, and we got to do allergy, and it was very, very good training, the beneficiary of that. And so I really enjoyed that, and I enjoyed doing the whole broad scale of family practice, similar to how my dad did in veterinary medicine, and delivered babies for over 30 years, and really enjoyed that. And even enjoyed delivering babies for some of those babies that I had delivered, 20, 25, 30 years ago. So that is a very joyful part of the practice.
Yeah, being able to take care of people across the generations, people as a family, seeing kids grow up, that's got to be awesome to see. And is that something that steered you towards family medicine and away from a more like a narrow subspecialty, something like that, where you would be, say, a ear, nose, and throat doctor, and you're sort of focused only on that? Did the, taking care of families, or was it the more broad use of skills that you were able to do in family medicine? What kind of steered you that way?
Probably the number one thing was the fact that I wanted to deliver babies, like my dad delivered puppies and kittens. But I also wanted to, take care of kids as they grew up. And family practice was the only residency that offered that. It was kind of a new residency at the time. Most people just got out of medical school, did a brief internship, and became general practitioner, and then got on the job experience, which is probably very similar to going through a residency. But the fact that there was a residency for that was very interesting to me. It was not as interesting to my dad, who did not have a residency, and he still pointed out to me that he had taken similar care of many different species, and I was only going to need to be taking care of one species, who, as you said, could talk and tell me what was wrong. And he really didn't understand why I wanted to do those additional years of training, but it was a really good thing. And I did receive excellent basic medical education at the University of Kansas and a really excellent residency training program. And I'm glad I did that. And then I also was very fortunate to join a really great group of physicians at College Park Family Care Center, who were a very strong group who did full practice primary care, delivered babies, did colonoscopies, EGDs, and they never saw a piece of equipment they didn't want to buy and use to help people. And to me, that was very exciting, and also was very wonderful to be in a group of like Kansas City, Johnson County area has tremendously fantastic groups of specialists that were easy to refer to and that had great relationships with my group and with me as a physician that really helped me be able to practice like that.
Yeah. And that's something that, having those specialists and that, knowledge and the networking there, that still benefits us at Gillette Health, having those connections even today. But if we go to when you first got out of residency, you joined College Park. Was it a big organization, very small organization? How many physicians were there in that group at the time?
Oh, I think there were probably about 10 or 12, and it grew to ultimately almost 100 providers. I think maybe it's closer to 80 now, but it was similar in many ways because medicine was different. We didn't have all the different groups that have impact on to telling you what you can do or not do. We didn't have pharmacy benefits managers. The insurance companies basically just paid for whatever you recommended. It was prior to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act being passed, which, as you know, had some pros and cons to it, as there was some bureaucracy added to medicine at all those steps. And so it was a very interesting time of medicine. And everything that's changed does have good and bad to it both. But I feel that at Gillette Health, I don't have to go through any bureaucracy. People can still have their insurance and still use that. That's fine. But if they're a member here, we don't have to. I don't have to have somebody do 6 weeks of physical therapy, and I don't have to have them take ibuprofen for 10 weeks because an MRI of their knee is not going to cost $2,000 through the insurance. It's going to be a few hundred dollars. A CT scan of their head is going to be $150 instead of $900. And the prices are so much cheaper that, and I can get it done almost immediately without having to ask for permission to various groups within the system. All the different payers, you know, Medicare, certainly all the big insurance companies. There are there's kind of cookbook medicine that I saw kind of happening that, well, you can't get this covered until you've tried this, and you can't have that medicine until you've tried this one. And I love that Gillette Health is the feel of when I first started practicing, where it was just me and the patient making decisions on what's best for the patient.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you have like so many more layers, and that's the bureaucracy you're referring to. And part of the reason is whenever you add a layer there, you're going to increase healthcare costs. So with healthcare costs, there's a lot of, I guess, fingers that get pointed, a lot of blame. So they will say, well, the drug manufacturers have their medications priced too high. And then people will say, well, the insurance premiums I'm paying are too high. And the insurance will say, well, that's because the hospital is charging too much for procedures and hospitalization, so we have to have high premiums. And then, you know, somewhere along the way, one of those groups will say, well, that's because doctors are charging too much and doctors are making too much money. And there's all this finger pointing that gets done. But where is the, if there is a root cause, where did you really see healthcare spending take off in a negative way, in a way that just sort of ballooned?
Well, definitely the regulatory burden or the bureaucracy has increased the price of healthcare a lot. Certainly, defensive medicine practices, standard of care.
So like defensive medicine, this is someone where you don't really think that they need a CT scan of their abdomen, but you're worried, well, if they do end up having something, they're going to come back and try and sue me. So that points to maybe even a societal level issue where people are, you know, lawyer happy and doctors have to practice defensive medicine. You correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the way I understand that to be.
I think there's some truth in that. And I have to say, because I have quite a few attorneys in my family, that they serve a wonderful purpose of making people conscious of practicing high quality standard of care medicine. Because if you practice standard of care medicine, then that's a defensible way if someone does sue you because of a bad outcome that you can defend against that. I would say that, unfortunately, that does make providers like you and me tend to order more tests sometimes. And I do also feel that if you communicate well with your patient and you explain to them, well, it's one chance in 1,000 that you might have something weird going on that we really need to do an MRI or whatever test. Do you want to try this treatment that I'm 90% sure will make your symptoms go away in a couple of weeks before we order that test? I think great communication can overcome a lot of the costs in healthcare.
Yeah, I think that, and that goes back to the patient-centered approach and shared decision-making and talking through whatever the pros or the cons might be and trying to gauge what as close as we can to the best of our ability, the true risk of something is and the true benefit of something is. And it should happen more, but there's some time constraints there in the traditional environment. And that's something that I've sort of pondered is, well, you know, can't providers, whether it's a PA or an NP or a physician out there, you know, can't they just spend twice as much time on each patient? And I think the answer is that yes, they could, but if they did cut their patient numbers in half, they would at least cut their salaries in half by 50%. A lot of times the productivity with the relative value units, which is how these corporations will measure productivity, will get more than just linearly slashed, but sort of exponentially lower if you're a, like, say, low producer. So is that a scenario that would be realistic, is for someone to just, you know, work in that traditional system and see half as many patients and spend twice as much time with them?
It might potentially be realistic depending on the system you're within, but a large publicly traded for-profit corporation is going to be very adverse to that, and they're going to find ways to financially incentivize you to see a lot more patients and financially disincentivize you from spending a lot of time with patients. So I think that's one way that practice has gone. One thing I love about Gillette Health is that I can spend as much time with somebody as I want. I can have as many follow-up visits with them as I want. It doesn't affect, unless they're, you know, of the four systems that people can decide to pay to come here, only one of those systems is affected by that. And the other systems, whether it's individualized medicine or direct primary care or concierge medicine, they basically can come see me and allocate that time however they want. If they want to come see me for an hour, I can literally spend an hour. And often with the first patient, the first time they're here, I spend an hour with them. Whereas in the more traditional medicine, we'd gone from 30 minutes to 20 minutes to 15 minutes to 10 minutes is what how much time I had with patients when I came to Gillette Health from the larger group. And they were talking about even potentially, in order to maintain my full staff, all of my staff, I had very, very great staff. I've always been very blessed to have great staff and wonderful patients and work with wonderful providers. But there was talk of the metric might change to where I would only be able to spend 5 minutes with a patient in order to have my full staff. And while I might be able to technically provide reasonably decent care, I don't think I would perceive it as great care, and I'm sure my patients wouldn't perceive it as great care. So I love it that at Gillette Health, my basic time unit is 15 minutes, but it's really oftentimes I spend 30 minutes with someone, and that's a true luxury.
Yeah, yeah, that's one of the things that I really enjoy here is not only that, you know, I have the time to spend with patients, but also time to think, right? If I'm already thinking about, oh, I've got such and such that's, you know, in there waiting and my clinic is running behind, you know, very rarely when I go to the doctor in the traditional setting is the office running on time. They're typically running behind unless you're lucky and you get an early morning appointment. If you're the first one on the schedule, then hopefully they're not running behind. But that's a very common complaint that people have. And one of the things that may have helped to alleviate that or improve a little bit of the efficiency is whenever telemedicine became a thing. And were you one of the early adopters of telemedicine when you were at College Park and a lot of things went virtual circa 2020 and COVID and all that?
We were fairly early adopters of that here. The interesting thing was Amanda Morris, one of the other providers here at Gillette Health, and I were in the initial meeting with Jeff Earle and Fred Church and some other people to make that start working. And we did jump in, and other than a group within our company that was already doing that before the pandemic, we were probably the most successful at adopting that early on. And then after the pandemic, it kind of went away. But I love that at Gillette Health, if somebody wants to do a virtual visit, the system here is very easy to use. The system that I had to use before was clunky and did not work very well. It was very hard for patients to access it. And it was even hard for me to access it. I sometimes told our IT folks who were excellent that they were trying to teach an old dog a new trick, and they would always laugh. But the experience there really helped me learn how to do that. And here I literally just push a couple buttons here. It's so easy to do those virtual visits, and it's an audio video visit, and the patients love it. It's so convenient. It saves them so much time. There's no incentive if they're a direct primary care or individualized medicine patient. There's no incentive for them to have to make a trip if there's no examination required as part of that. If they just have a question about a potential question about medications or this or that.
Yeah. And I mean, video calling has been around for a long, long time, but it hardly ever made its way into medicine or healthcare, other than, you know, board meetings and conference meetings and that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden now it's being used as a sort of bridge or even, you know, standard of care for some appointment types. You know, with a telephone visit, I think a big thing was, you know, Medicare decided that they're going to reimburse for telephone or audio video calls like that. So it was really surprising to me that it hadn't been adopted sooner. But at the same time, I wasn't thinking of that in my mind. I wasn't like, oh, like, why aren't we doing this? If I'm thinking like back to 2018, you know, hadn't crossed my mind for sure. So I think it's a really positive thing. And we've said before, we have patients who live 2 miles from here, but, you know, they like being at home or having it scheduled out in their day, and it saves them, you know, the traffic and the commute time. And it's just, it does seem to improve efficiency in the context where, you know, there's not a physical exam that's needed. So you can't do everything virtually. The joke I like to give is, you know, don't try to do the Romberg test on somebody in a virtual visit. That won't end well. Our clinicians out there will chuckle a little bit at that one. But yeah, I think it's been a really good feature of our practice and for most practices that are doing the telemedicine now for efficiency. So I guess shifting back into, you know, the healthcare costs and medications, I'm just curious on your opinion of, like, is it the drug companies that are charging too much? Is it the pharmacy benefits managers? You say PBMs, and I don't know what a lot of the general public knows of that layer of, like, the bureaucracy that we alluded to. So, I mean, just in simple terms, what is a pharmacy benefits manager?
Well, a pharmacy benefits manager is someone who the insurance companies have hired to help them manage what they pay for as far as medications. And back in the day, that was physicians. And I was on quite a few different groups for different insurance companies that there would be four or five of physicians that would volunteer their time to sit down and give our advice to how can we take good care of their patients and keep them healthy. And we would say, well, you need this medicine and that medicine. And there was a discussion between practitioners, and everybody had a seat at the table. Whereas the pharmacy benefits managers, I think, are somewhat of a middle person or middleman in the system. And so they're being paid to do something of how to apportion the medicines and in a cost-effective way. And I'm oversimplifying this too much. Whereas before, drug companies would spend a very large amount of money developing a drug, testing a drug, and getting it through the FDA. And the general fund paid for a lot of the cost of the Food and Drug Administration. Now, pharmaceutical companies bear the great amount of the cost of running the FDA. And so it may take $1 billion or more dollars to get a medicine approved. And then the drug companies would come and market that to you and me as providers and say, hey, here's what our drug can do. Here's the side effects. And the FDA regulated what they could tell us. And I think that was a very efficient way because you're just marketing to a small group of providers. Sometimes that was very cost effective. Whereas now drug companies, to really compete, they have to often pay for national TV ad campaigns, which are very, very expensive. Also, there's a lot of class action lawsuits against drug companies for drugs for side effects that are known side effects, but that are rare. And so I think the pharmaceutical industry spends a lot of money on TV advertising their product, but sometimes these big law firms can spend money advertising, say, call us if you had this side effect or if you took this drug. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, the pharmaceutical companies have to have insurance to pay the cost of litigation or else paying for damages. And I think, again, patients get some of that money, but the law firms get some of that money. And a lot of that money goes into media advertising, both sides on the, you know, the large class action lawsuit and the pharmaceutical company. And so when you're trying to make the pie bigger, you're maybe costing the system a lot of money that doesn't turn into that much bang for the buck for the patient, because a provider like you or me still has to decide, is this the right drug for this patient? And I think that in many ways, the length of the patent life. I believe, certainly no patent expert, but I think the patent life starts when the pharmaceutical company discovers the compound. And then all the testing takes many years. So they may only get to sell the drug for 10 years, whereas they discovered it twice that long ago. And so they're going to have to charge more because they're selling it for a shorter amount of time. And yeah. So there's many different factors that go into that. And when you're paying pharmacy benefits managers a lot of the money for rebates or whatever to put your drug on the panel so that a provider like you or me can prescribe it for the patient, there's somebody in the middle between you and me and the patient that's getting paid to do that, that is going to be incentivized in some ways to make it more of a financial decision than a true healthcare decision, which is what you and I care about for our patients and what our patients care about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a financial conflict of interest almost. And, you know, you were just talking about a scenario where a drug is a good candidate and does get approved. There's billions of dollars in failed drug candidates. I mean, if you look at all the clinical trials that have been run up to this point for the Alzheimer's drugs or dementia medications, you know, they've largely not been successful. And the ones that are marginally helpful and perhaps more harmful, arguably, you know, there's opinions on both sides there. But yeah, the PBMs in simple terms, I think, with this rebate or this, what do they call it, where they have a, the word is escaping me at the moment, but they have this rebate or they have a spread. Spread is the other term.
Yes.
So they have, let's say X drug costs $1,000 a month. They say, well, we'd like to give this to patients at, you know, $400 a month. Can you give us a $600 rebate, or, you know, this gap is $600, but then the patient may still end up paying $900 for the drug and they're going to keep the $500 that's there. So I think that's a scenario that also happens, just making numbers up, but that's kind of a simple scenario of potentially how large that, you know, pool of profit can be. I've seen cases of anywhere from, you know, 20 to 50% of that rebate is kept, you know, by the PBM and PBM groups.
Yes, and that is money that someone's being paid a large percentage of the cost of that medicine just to intercalate themselves and interpose themselves between the patient and the provider, and sometimes in ways that makes it harder to take care of a patient. And in some ways, you can have outcomes affected by that because formularies will say you have to try this generic before we pay for this one. And it was very interesting. There was one medicine that worked very well for a certain problem. I won't say the medicine because it would be easy to see the pharmaceutical company and the insurance company that were involved. But they would not pay for that when it was brand name because it did not have studies and an approval from the FDA for that, even though it worked well for it. Well, that medicine went generic, but a company came out with another medicine that was brand name that did have an FDA approval for that problem. Well, the insurance company and or pharmacy benefits manager said, well, you can't have the brand name medicine to treat that problem for that patient until you've tried the generic medicine that still does not have an FDA approval to treat that. But that was very hypocritical, and there's many instances of that, and that's what happens when the system becomes more financially driven as far as what they will pay for to allow us to take care of patients, which I think is even all the more incumbent upon us, groups like Gillette Health, to keep people healthy, to optimize people's health care at a very early point in their lives and not wait until people have these health problems where they need these expensive medicines, which many times are miraculous. The pharmaceutical industry is amazing. And it's maybe 10, 15, 20% of the cost of medical care. It's kind of like providers are a small percentage of the cost of medical care. Hospital systems are the biggest chunk of the cost of medical care. It's not the medicines, it's not the providers, but it's when providers fail to treat patients early enough or patients don't come in to get healthy. And when they don't get enough sleep or enough exercise and they don't eat healthy food or they don't eat the right amount of food or they don't get treated for issues they may have inherited genetically, like osteoporosis or hypertension or diabetes or high cholesterol. And then we end up paying very expensive interventions in hospitals. And we have tremendously fantastic specialists and tremendously wonderful hospitals to do that. But I think if we can get at the root cause and keep people healthy at a very early stage of that, which is what we are all about here, I just love the preventative nature of Gillette Health, of how we are so focused like a laser beam on keeping people healthy and optimizing their health. That's how we save, I think, the healthcare industry in the United States and perhaps in other developed countries around the world, by getting people healthy. And another plug for primary care is we do have studies now showing that the more primary care people you have per 10,000 patients in an area, the less expensive the overall care is, because primary care people do preventative things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is covered now. You know, there's pros and cons of trying to legislate what insurance companies pay for and what they don't. But primary care is a lot of bang for your buck. So, you know, if you go get a DEXA bone density test before you have a fractured bone, if you get a colonoscopy and take the polyp out before you have colon cancer, you know, if you take a blood pressure medicine before you have a stroke, if you take, if you exercise, if you get enough sleep, if you treat sleep apnea, all these things are such low-hanging fruit that we can take care of here. And I've been shocked. What we pay for tests through Gillette Health for patients is amazing, how little it costs our patients to get these things done.
Yeah. People might be surprised that, you know, if they run something through insurance, that price that the same lab company is going to say is 15 or 20x higher, that they can just pay cash for that and they get a price that's 15, 20 times lower. So preventive is, I think, the way this is all shifting. Like if we look at the, you know, maybe the silver lining of COVID is, you know, more people are interested in their health. They realize that, you know, I'm not invincible. You know, there's things and measures I can take to be proactive and prevent these negative things, whether we're talking about, you know, back in 2020 or talking about a hip fracture, or talking about having a heart attack. Now, there's things that anyone can do really at any age to reduce their risk of those. And the earlier you start, to your point about primary care, you know, the more that's going to pay in dividends. It's kind of like, you know, planning out your retirement. If you wait till you're 75 years old and you've got zero retirement, you know, it's a lot, it's not impossible, but it's a lot more of an uphill battle than if you start when you're 20 or 25, you know, start thinking about these things earlier in life and it'll pay dividends for your health. And I think going back to the hospital systems, this is a opinion I have, and I just want to see what you think about it, in terms of an unnecessary spending problem. There's a lot of very nice hospitals. And there's nothing wrong with nice things, but if you have a hospital that has a $2 million water feature in the lobby, somebody has to ask the question of, you know, is that truly necessary? And then also, you know, where are the dollars coming from to pay for that? So that's sort of my opinion, is that, you know, these buildings are very nice. You know, people have big hospital rooms now. All private rooms, no semi-private rooms anymore, is I think what it's all moving towards. But that does incur additional costs because you've got more square footage. Every hospital room is going to have a flat screen TV in it and all the latest streaming and et cetera, because I guess you have to compete. You want people to come to your hospital. And if you're sharing a room and you got no TV, you're probably not going to go to that hospital if it's your choice. So it's sort of a self-fulfilling problem where, because of one person doing it, everyone has to do it to compete. But, you know, do we need $2 million water features in hospital lobbies? And whose money is that coming from?
Well, obviously the system does have a lot of wiggle room built into it. And I think when we shielded people from actually paying for part of their healthcare, or the insurance company or the employer buying the insurance, you know, pays for whatever the hospital charges or negotiates rates. And then when everybody has a beautiful hospital, because people do want a flat screen TV and they do like the water feature and they do choose those things, then I think what happens is there is less competition based on quality and price, because similar to how pharmacy benefits managers are choosing the medicines you can be on, then your company chooses the insurance company that you're on, and then they choose the features of the insurance company. They negotiate the prices at the hospital, which hospital system you can go to. And when we have people making choices for patients where the patients feel like they have very little say in what the money is actually spent on, and my patients would all vote when I have, you know, if somebody has a appendicitis and they have an appendectomy, they want the money spent on nurses. And because when they have a pain problem and they push their button, they would like a nurse to appear the minute before they push the button. And I understand that. I think I would vote that same way. But then hospitals end up spending a lot more money on water features and things that aren't important to the patients or not as important. And then they spend less money on nurses. And then the government has to get involved and has to say, well, you have to have this nurse ratio. And what happens is nurses aren't paid as much as perhaps what they should be to attract enough people to go into nursing, especially following during the pandemic and following the pandemic. And so what we have is we have beautiful hospitals with beautiful fireplaces and beautiful water features and those types of things that you mentioned, but we don't have enough nurses to really take care of the patients that when they're hurting or when they're sick and that light goes off, the person pushes the button. It takes a few minutes sometimes for somebody to get in there and help them. And as a patient, I would perceive having a great nurse available to help me when I was hurting or having problems or getting sick, I would think that would be more important than having some of the nice physical features of the hospital. And in a perfect world, maybe we would all vote to have both. But if I had to have one or the other for my patients, I think I'll take the world-class nurses with world-class response time better than the world-class flat-screen TV and the water feature.
Yeah. You know, you don't care how big the TV is or what show's on if you're in 10 out of 10 pain and you're wanting that to go away. I think that's a great point. And then maybe we can just sort of segue this whole journey. And, you know, we've sort of, you know, I think if people were looking for a simple answer to the healthcare costs, we've probably disappointed them sorely. But the fact of the matter is there is no simple answer there. And we've sort of tried to unpack some of those layers and, you know, things that from your, you know, 30 plus years of experience working in that system and seeing it change and seeing these inefficiencies and advocating for your staff and trying to do right by the patients in that very challenging environment, that it's not easy. But now, you know, coming into Gillette Health, you have, you know, so much happiness every day. You come in and you're like excited to be here. You're loving spending time with the patients. So I guess just kind of compare and contrast that. So I know you said they were, you know, considering axing the visit time from 10 minutes to 5 minutes. You see a patient here for an hour. How does that help you to really help somebody?
I guess the only way you could defend that is say if you need more staff, you should be able to see more patients. You should be able to help more people because you have the additional staff. And so you can see people more quickly because you can delegate to your staff. And I understand that that is kind of for a while how the healthcare system was going. But what I see here at Gillette Health is really, really exciting to me. I see people getting the idea with the health sharing systems like Zion. And people are saying, even if I have company insurance, I can still do a direct primary care plan and maybe not have to spend as much toward my deductible. And people's deductibles are sometimes several times higher than what it costs to have a really good direct primary care plan here at Gillette Health. So I also see people opting out of the buying the traditional insurance, which has gotten very expensive because of all these factors, and buying a health share plan. And there are several really good ones out there. I know a lot of my patients here like the Zion plan and combining that with a direct primary care, and that's health sharing. And then really it is it's the patient and the provider making the decisions for their health care. I don't have to spend time talking, doing a peer-to-peer with a medical director. And I understand the reason for that. I came from that system, but it could be frustrating trying to talk to someone who hasn't seen your patient and doesn't understand why they're worried about needing an MRI. You know, here an MRI is a fraction of the cost, and we just order the MRI and or CT scan or whatever that we need. So I see the system, I see people voting more toward more freedom and more choice for their healthcare. And maybe I'm just seeing that more now because I have a lot more patients here that are seeking care here because they want that. But I think also a lot of my patients that I saw at College Park have followed me here because they want the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think more and more people are trying to be proactive with their health. Like we said, that's sort of the way this tide is turning. And, you know, more and more direct primary cares and concierge and telemedicine services are popping up outside of that system where people just go and it's, you know, they pay their fee or they pay for a membership. And then, you know, really what they're paying for is the knowledge and time of the clinician, whether it's a PA or an NP or a physician or even specialists now. I've seen, you know, let us know if you're cash pay, because then they're going to have a lower upfront rate to not deal with all the, you know, back and forth with reimbursement rates and renegotiating contracts. And the patient can just get in and see the expert that they need to. So I think it's a wonderful thing. Any closing thoughts that you have? Any other areas that we need to tap into and explore? You're just a wealth of knowledge with all your experience.
Well, thank you. I like to tell jokes. My patients tell me jokes and I tell jokes. And I do have a joke that kind of sheds light on perception is everything. So there's a lady who was hurrying to the hospital. She was her third baby or fourth baby, and she wasn't going to make it. So her husband pulled over to the side of the road and called the EMT. The paramedics came and they delivered the baby and right there in the front seat of the car. And then the four-year-old daughter was watching from the back seat, leaning over. And of course, back in the day, you give the baby a little swat to get it to breathe and stimulate it. We dry them off vigorously now. But as the joke goes, the baby had a swat on the bottom. And his older sister said, "Swat him again." And they said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, so he remembers not to crawl up in here in there and cause so much problems ever again." So I think it's our perception of how we look at things, and I'm very optimistic for healthcare because I think we're working toward solving some of these problems where access to healthcare needs to be improved, the quality of healthcare needs improved, the amount of time that providers and patients spend together, but as much as anything, the quality of that time and the focus on keeping people healthy rather than fixing problems, I think that's where there's tremendous opportunity and savings in the system where we can have a better system in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the time with the provider and even time in between visits is just so important. You know, here, patients can send as many messages as they want to. If I go to my traditional primary care doctor, I could pull up the app right now. It's going to say any medical advice given via a message may be considered a billable encounter. And that's a question mark. I don't know how much they're going to bill me for that. I know some places will bill $50 a message. So, you know, that's humorous to me. It's also sad, but to me, I can kind of laugh about it because I think it's just silly and people should be able to communicate with their doctor. And that's exactly what we have here. It's just so much good communication. So
yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, sitting down and telling us all about how you got started, your story, where you're at now. And if patients are interested, they can go to our website or click the link in the description and check out Dr. Mark Gillette, his services, and perhaps even become a patient.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.